Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 3rd. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. Well, first let's have a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area, it will be mostly sunny, wind from the southwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 72 and a low of 43. Tomorrow, Sunday, it'll be mostly sunny, with a high of 75 and a low of 54. Then on Monday, we'll have a chance of storms and it will be windy, with a high of 76 and a low of 57. On Tuesday, another chance of storms with a high of 72 and a low of 55. The normal high for this day is 58 and the normal low 35. The record high was 80 in 2001. The record low was 11 in 1975. The sun will set tonight at 7:35. It will rise tomorrow at 6:44. We have a little weather story today, this one from meteorologist Kaylee Plichel. Easter weather history. March and April in general can be very up and down months when it comes to weather, and Easter is no different. Our coldest low in Cedar Rapids was 6 degrees in 1894, and our record high was 87 degrees in 1925. On average, temperatures for Easter are in the mid to upper 50s. Over the past 5 years, highs have ranged from the 30s in 2018 to the 80s in 2019. The most snow fell in 1917 at 0.6 inch in Cedar Rapids, and the most rain in 1956 at 1.25 inches. Records for snow on Easter were higher in Iowa City. Let me begin that sentence again. Records for snow on Easter were higher in Iowa City, Waterloo, and Dubuque than Cedar Rapids, sitting between 2 and 3 inches. Easter is shaping up to be nice this year, with highs in the 70s and partly cloudy skies. And again, that little weather story is from meteorologist Kaylee Plichel. And now we'll turn to the first story, this from the front page of today's Gazette. Rides give seniors a shot in the arm. Meals on Wheels transports homebound seniors. And this story is by Michaela Ram of the Gazette. As the COVID-19 vaccines become available to every adult in the state, some local entities are working to ensure homebound seniors aren't left behind in the shuffle. Starting Monday, the state will open eligibility for the vaccine to any adult in Iowa, regardless of age or underlying health condition. Demand already far outweighs supplies of the shots, and public health officials have continued to warn that vaccines may not be readily available in the near future. But the move to open availability also has prompted concern that seniors at high risk for severe outcomes from the virus may be left behind in the scramble to find appointments. Quote, that's the hard part. How do you know if you're able to reach all those that have that need? Asked Eugenia Kendall, Quality and Outcomes Senior Manager at the Heritage Care Agency on Aging in Cedar Rapids. Local agencies that work with older residents have made the effort in recent weeks to ensure their clients who want a vaccine are able to get it, even if it means driving them to the appointments. Janice Engelman, Welty, 66, is a homebound Cedar Rapids resident who needed exactly that. On Friday morning, Kay Fisk, Vice President for Advocacy and Donor Relations for Horizons, picked up Engelman Welty, drove her to the Linn County Public Health Building. There, she received her first dose of the vaccine. She's among a dozen or so Meals on Wheels clients who had their COVID-19 vaccine appointments scheduled by the Cedar Rapids-based agency, which has made a concerted effort in recent days to offer assistance to homebound seniors locally. Over the past few weeks, Horizons, which operates the meal delivery service, had been calling its roughly 650 clients to gauge whether they needed help finding an appointment and if they needed transportation. Of those, about 70 clients expressed interest, Fisk said. So far, about 15 clients have had their appointments scheduled, which are coordinated with Linn County Public Health through an allocation of doses set aside specifically for vulnerable populations. Fisk said, quote, "Since the derecho and COVID-19, we've wanted to do everything we could for our older adults." Engelman Welty is scheduled for her second dose later this month and will again be taken to it by a Meals on Wheels volunteer. Without that transportation, Engelman Welty was concerned she wouldn't be able to receive a COVID-19 shot. She said she's been disabled for about 20 years from a few health conditions, including neuropathy and fibromyalgia, and is unable to drive. She also can't afford other local transportation services, she said. Engelman Welty said, quote, "It kept me up all night worrying about it." Many of the seniors at Horizons Many of the seniors Horizons works with are not technologically savvy and lack the skills needed to schedule an appointment online through a local pharmacy, said Mary Griffin, volunteer manager at the agency. In other cases, clients said their doctor's offices were unable to give them the vaccine, so they were unsure of where to turn to next. When Engelman Welty heard earlier that vaccine eligibility was open for Iowans age 65 and older, she wanted to schedule an appointment, but didn't understand how to navigate the different websites. She said, So I was really concerned I wouldn't be able to get a vaccine. But then Meals on Wheels called, asking if she needed assistance getting the shot. Engelman Welty said, quote, "I was thrilled. I said, yes, I need help. The issue of internet access will not go away anytime soon, even as the vaccine supply increases and appointments become more available," Kendall said. "It's important agencies that work with seniors continue their outreach efforts, but it's also difficult to track whether they're reaching everyone in need," she said. Kendall said, quote, "There's an element of reaching out to see who's still in need, but folks also need to speak up. They need to advocate for themselves if there are challenges so people can help them with that." Kendall also encouraged residents to help their neighbors if they can, noting it's not just a public health issue, but a community issue. She said, quote, "If people know of someone who is homebound or seems not as able to get out, see what you can do to help." As she gets closer to being fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, Engelman Welty said she's most looking forward to seeing her children and three grandchildren, who she hasn't seen for a year. "Making plans to see them after the second dose feels wonderful," she said. "I'm really grateful," she said. Linn begging state for vaccine equity. Letter: one-shot doses should go to vulnerable Iowans. And this also is by Michaela Ram of the Gazette. The state's decision to allocate one-shot COVID-19 vaccines to colleges and employers is heartbreaking to local public health officials who have been requesting, even begging, for several weeks to receive the doses to administer to vulnerable populations, Linn County Public Health wrote this week in an emotional plea. In a letter Wednesday, Linn County Public Health asked the governor's office to allocate the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to local public health agencies and let them decide what's best for their jurisdictions. it is becoming increasingly clear that the governor's office does not trust local public health to identify and serve individuals in our community who are most vulnerable, wrote Tricia Kintzman, Community Health Division Manager, in the letter. She continued, quote, I'm struggling to understand why will the governor's office not listen to those that know their communities best and work with us to identify the best strategies to vaccinate our community. Both manufacturing, businesses, higher education, and the most vulnerable and susceptible to barriers to accessing vaccine and experience social determinants of health. Kintzman's letter was sent to leaders at the Iowa Department of Public Health, including Director Kelly Garcia. The letter first was reported by KCRG-TV. Kintzman said in an interview with the Gazette that since the beginning of the pandemic, local public health officials have dealt with disjointed communications from state officials and a lack of transparency from the governor's office. Because of that lack of transparency, Kintzman said it's hard for local officials to know how state input has impacted vaccine distribution, namely whether communities are getting their fair share of doses. She said, quote, there's a lot of complicated things that go with that. I don't know how the community is being impacted because I don't know how those decisions are being made. The state public health department pushed back on that characterization. A department spokeswoman, Sarah Ekstrand, said in a statement, quote, the IDPH works on a daily basis with local public health vaccine providers and community organizations to balance the needs of all the state's vulnerable populations. Each of the state's counties will receive at least 100 Johnson & Johnson doses next week, she added. Since sending the email Wednesday morning, Kintzman told the Gazette the department has received word it will receive an additional 500 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, bringing next week's total allocation to 1,200 doses. These additional doses, which will be directed to vulnerable residents who might have difficulty getting to the two appointments required by the other vaccines, had been declined by other counties and returned to the state for redistribution. This week, Governor Kim Reynolds announced a large allocation of Johnson & Johnson doses will be sent to colleges and universities, and Kirkwood Community College is in consideration to receive those shots. The simplicity of the vaccine and the fast approaching end to the semester are the reasons it was offered to colleges, Ekstrand said. Ekstrand wrote, quote, vaccinating students before they return home reduces the risk to them. Vaccinating students before they return home reduces the risk of them spreading the virus to family members and ensures they have been vaccinated before returning to campus in the fall. In addition, Hy-Vee is receiving 3,200 doses of the one-shot vaccine specifically for Collins Aerospace employees, according to Kintzman. Ekstrand said resources needed from local providers to implement two-dose clinics are considerably increased, meaning some employers have opted for a one-dose clinic. Linn County Public Health questioned the governor's office in the letter about why it was opting to allocate the Johnson & Johnson doses to vaccinate very high-functioning and health-literate professional populations. While public health officials are always thrilled to have more shots in arms, Kintzman said in an interview with the Gazette, it's still important to ensure equity. Professional populations are often well-resourced, technologically savvy, and capable of attending two-dose clinics. The state's decision was frustrating, Kintzman said. It just felt wrong. Public health officials have said the one-shot dose is ideal for vulnerable populations, which they've identified as including those who face barriers to health care or are homeless, and immigrant, minority, and low-income populations. Extrin said in the statement, quote, "Our plan has always been to use Johnson & Johnson vaccines for the populations who might be more at risk for scheduling or adhering to a second appointment. Many of the employers who have received Johnson & Johnson to date employ the populations referenced." Local public health officials say they understand the pockets of the population that are most vulnerable and have established relationships with leaders in those communities to help reach those individuals. Kinsman said to the Gazette, quote, "My job is to be that safety net, to ensure those populations are reached and not overlooked. Someone in Des Moines simply cannot do that." Linn County Public Health had been working with local agencies in recent weeks to find solutions for vaccinating residents who face barriers. With the additional allocation expected next week, Kinsman said officials will expand the targeted clinics planned to reach those experiencing homelessness, refugees and immigrants, and Latino residents. "It's also a priority to vaccinate inmates at the Linn County Jail," Kinsman said. I'll turn to the Iowa Today page for this story. How should Cedar Rapids replenish trees downed in derecho? Website invites public input, which will guide planning. And the story is by Marissa Payne of the Gazette. The team leading the effort to re-leaf the community after last summer's derecho downed most of the city's tree canopy is asking citizens for their ideas about reviving the lost urban forest. The website, which is confluence.mysocialpinpoint.com/reliefCedar Rapids, is one way the Relief Initiative is gathering public input for the long-term, multi-million-dollar public-private partnership to replenish the trees lost in the August 10th storm. This process, spanning several months, will include virtual meetings, polling, and questionnaires to identify the community priorities and draft a plan to guide replanting. On the website, residents can rank 13 principles such as climate action, resilience, species diversity, and beauty and character to say what is most important to them, said Patrick Alvord from the local landscape architecture firm Confluence. Among the principles is the question of equality versus equity in replanting, whether trees should be replanted in an equal canopy across neighborhoods, or whether low-income neighborhoods should be prioritized because the benefits of trees may be particularly impactful in areas where residents struggle. Albert said, quote, "We've known for a long time that underserved neighborhoods tend to be under-canopied as well, or not have access to outdoor areas in the same way that other neighborhoods do." The website will be updated regularly with new surveys and other opportunities. One of the website's key features is a mapping tool that will help the team quantify tree loss on private property. People may use markers to indicate where they lost a tree, where they would like to plant a tree, and where they have planted a tree. The Relief team can use that information to reach out to citizens to inform them of tree adoptions or other programs, Albert said. With private trees also contributing to the overall tree canopy, helping advance replanting in those spaces will be key, he said. Trees Forever founding president Shannon Ramsey encouraged Stute residents to plant high-quality trees and good native species on their property and to learn how to properly plant and care for them. Ramsey said, quote, "We're not suggesting anyone wait to plant." Ramsey, late last year, gave an educated estimate that 100,000 trees were lost in the Cedar Rapids metro area during the derecho. City officials have estimated 70% of the public tree canopy was downed by the derecho's hurricane-force winds. Albert said, quote, "Our goal is not to do a one-to-one replacement, but over the long term to substantially increase the urban tree canopy. The overall red leaf plan will include detailed replanting plans for public spaces, including 38 city parks, and identify the quantity and species to plant in various timeframes." Cedar Rapids has partnered with Confluence, a Marion-based nonprofit, Trees Forever, and urban planner Jeff Speck to form the replanting plan by October. The City Council in February agreed to give $500,000 to Trees Forever to craft the urban reforestation plan for public and private spaces. Tree Forever also is handling private fundraising. The new fiscal year budget includes $1 million for the Relief Initiative, the first of what will be a multi-year expenditure, and $24,000 for watering new trees during their first 2 years. Replanting is expected to take at least 10 years, City Parks and Recreation Director Scott Hawk said. For now, Hawk said, the city still is in cleanup mode, as the April 19th deadline for free curbside tree debris pickup approaches. Debris also is being picked up in improved areas of city parks. If residents want to help clean up a park or volunteer in some way, they can go to park@cedarrapids.org or check the city's municipal volunteer program page at cedarrapids.org. Here is a guest editorial that first appeared in the Washington Post. President Joe Biden bills his eight-year, $2 trillion American jobs plan as an infrastructure proposal. But its notion of infrastructure encompasses far more than the traditional definition of that term. Along with $621 billion for highways, bridges, water systems, ports, and the like, the bill will provide $400 billion for the care economy, home and community-based services for the disabled and elderly, and $50 billion to subsidize semiconductor manufacturing. And the list goes on, to be paid for over 15 years by significantly higher taxes on U.S. corporations. Biden's plan represents an unapologetic commitment to a bigger federal government with bigger responsibilities for the foreseeable future. In announcing this strategy shift, Biden has three advantages. The first two are political. He is in tune with public opinion, at least in the sense that 52% of Americans, roughly the percentage of votes he won in 2020, now say they prefer a bigger government providing more services versus 45% who want a smaller government providing fewer services, according to Pew Research. Meanwhile, his Republican opponents have themselves shifted in favor of more active government during the Trump era. Infrastructure was a priority for President Donald Trump, too, as were tariffs, border controls, and a bigger defense budget. The political constituency for laissez-faire economics has all but collapsed. Third and most important, Biden's plan addresses real needs, both on the spending and the revenue sides. There are many details we do not know, and the bill will inevitably change as Congress works on it. However, to the extent it addresses long-standing backlogs in transportation maintenance and water supply safety, and in preventing climate change and increasing the United States' resilience in the face of unavoidable climate impacts, the priorities are sound. And insofar as it pays for itself, at least in part, by correcting unduly light business taxation, the plan strikes blows for both equality and fiscal responsibility. But there is a reason Biden's predecessor, Bill Clinton, once felt constrained to declare the era of big government is over. The public grew disenchanted with Democratic policies of the 1960s and 70s, sometimes justifiably. The enduring lesson is that government should do more of what it does best. Government has a comparative advantage in providing public goods, education, training, roads, ports, basic research, which indeed figure largely in Biden's plan. When it comes to allocating investment capital, however, picking winners among alternative industries, companies, technologies, and locations, the private sector ordinarily performs better. Biden's plan shifts hundreds of billions of dollars from the private sector to the public sector on the theory that the latter can put them to better use than the former. It's a bold and potentially historic move whose results could shape the country's future, political and economic, for generations. And again, that is a guest editorial that first appeared in the Washington Post on Thursday of this past week. And now we'll move down the insight page to community letters. And today there's just one letter, this one from Barb Kulback of Dexter. Trying to stop a factory farm. Let me read that again. Trying to stop a factory farm, Iowa CCI will help fight back. In 2002, Iowa's Environmental Protection Commission overturned a decision made by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources that would have allowed a factory farm to be built with over 7,200 sows less than half a mile from our home. Hundreds of our neighbors joined the fight to stop this factory farm. That factory farm would not have been denied without Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, a statewide organization that I've been a member of since. When the DNR still chose to approve the permit, Iowa CCI organized with us to appeal the DNR's decision to the EPC. For years, Iowa CCI members have been taking on corporate power and organizing against local factory farm proposals across Iowa. With the cards so stacked against us in these fights, organizing experience is key. Iowa is already home to over 10,000 factory farms. We can't afford to allow any more. Every year, hundreds more factory farms are added to our communities, using up our aquifers and polluting our waterways. Enough is enough. If there is a proposed factory farm near you and you're ready to fight back, Iowa CCI can help. Call us at 515-282-0484. And again, that letter is from Barb Kulback of Dexter. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 3rd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First, we have some short notices from Monticello. Donna Annabelle Smith, 88, died Thursday, April 1st. Arrangements are with the Gutch Funeral Home of Monticello. From Tama, Suzanne K. Moorfeld, 78, died Thursday, April 1st. Arrangements are with the Cruz Phillips Funeral Home of Tama, Toledo. From Williamsburg, Gerald F. Maas, that's spelled M-A-A-S, 93, died Friday, April 2nd. Arrangements are with the Powell Funeral Home of Williamsburg. And now we'll move down the page to the longer notices. From Cedar Rapids, Dorothy L. Beardsley, 89, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, April 1st, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Dorothy's wishes were cremation with no services. Interment will take place at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is handling the arrangements. From Iowa City, Hope, also known as Deborah Louthan, 64, of Iowa City, passed away at her home on Tuesday, March 30th. Visitation will be held Friday, April 9th, from noon to 1 p.m. at Lansing Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Services will begin at 1 p.m. at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Oakland Cemetery in Iowa City. From West Branch, Lillian Claire Cooper, 91, of West Branch and formerly of Iowa City and Grinnell, died on March 26th at her home of natural causes. A graveside service and burial has been scheduled for 10 a.m. Saturday, April 17th at Hazelwood Cemetery in Grinnell. From Cedar Rapids, Herbert Frederick Beer, 96, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday, March 27th, at Meadowview Memory Care Center. A visitation will be held on Monday, April 5th, at Cedar Memorial West Side Chapel from 5 to 7 p.m. A private service will be held for the family. Burial will take place at St. John's Lutheran Cemetery in Homestead. From Cedar Rapids, Theodore Winfield Carter, 78, of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 1st. A public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on April 9th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories stateroom. A private family service will be held at the Chapel of Memories with burial following at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Coralville, Dennis Fratsky passed away on March 31st in Iowa City after battling cancer. No services have been planned at this time. A memorial will be held at a later date when we can gather safely. From Cedar Rapids, Amelia, also known as Amy Jenny Gearhart, 90, of Cedar Rapids, died at her home on Thursday, April 1st, following a short illness. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday at St. Jude Catholic Church by the Reverend Mark Murphy. Burial will be at St. Joseph's Cemetery. Friends are welcome to attend a vigil service for Amy at 4 p.m. on Monday at Tehan Funeral Home. Those not attending the vigil service may visit with the family from 4:30 to 7 p.m. From Cedar Rapids, William, also known as Butch Loftus, that's spelled L-O-F-T-U-S, 80, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, March 31st, in his home. Services will be private. A visitation will be held on Tuesday, April 6th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home from 4 to 7 p.m. Interment will take place at St. John's Cemetery. From Buchanan County, Ruth Bovenmeyer, 91, a lifelong resident of Buchanan County, died at her home of complications of Alzheimer's on Wednesday, March 25th. Memorial services will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 10th, at the Monty Hall in Monty, Iowa. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday and from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. on Saturday at the Monty Hall. From Cedar Rapids, Bradley P. Thompson, 65, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Monday, March 29th, at his home. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, April 5th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Private services will take place on Tuesday, April 6th, at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. From North Mankato, Minnesota, Barbara Rowland, 84, of North Mankato, formerly of Marion, Iowa, died Wednesday, March 31st, at Monarch Meadows in North Mankato. Funeral services will be held on Tuesday, April 6th, at 10 a.m. at Northview, North Mankato Mortuary. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service at Northview. Burial will be at North Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. From North English, Carol Ann Ballard passed away on Thursday, April 1st, at Compass Memorial Hospital in Marengo at the age of 77. A celebration of life service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, April 6th, at Powell Funeral Home in North English. Burial will be in the North English Cemetery. Visitation will be Monday from 3 to 6 p.m. at Powell Funeral Home in North English. And finally, from Iowa City, Kevin Lee Snyder passed away on Saturday, March 27th, at the age of 69. A celebration of life will be held this summer in Iowa City. Now we'll turn to the sports page. No wavering from Bowie. West Branch recruit destined to be a Hawkeye. And this story is by Leah Van of the Gazette. Iowa football-bound defensive end Jeffrey Bowie has a tattoo on his forearm that reads, Loyalty. He got it this year over spring break in Kansas City with his dad, Tom. It's not that there's a story there. The word just means a lot to him. Eventually, he hopes to get a whole sleeve, but this was his first step. Tom said, quote, he wanted a lion on his shoulder, but that was going to be a multiple trip tattoo, and they weren't able to get working on that. Jeffrey isn't yet 18, which is why he had to go out of state with his dad to get it. It was his second father-son spring break trip. Last year, the two went to Milwaukee to see the Bucks play. The Miami Heat, Jeffrey's favorite team. But the pandemic abruptly sidelined all sports. Instead, the two walked around in empty Milwaukee, indulging in the city's German cuisine. He wasn't there to see the Bucks, but the Heat. He grew up watching LeBron James and Dwayne Wade in what was the beginning of an era of super teams. Most people follow players in the NBA, but he stuck with the team even after the players left. Jeffrey doesn't waver, period. Much like his professional allegiances, he knew he wanted to be an Iowa Hawkeye, but he tried to give everyone a fair chance. He garnered interest from schools like Indiana, Iowa State, and Kansas State, and Minnesota. Once he's committed, he's in. He played his junior football season at West Branch with a partially torn labrum and tried to play through basketball until he physically couldn't. Quote, during football, I would get knocked down a certain way, and I couldn't move it for a little bit. But then after a couple of minutes, I'd be fine, Jeffrey said. During the basketball game against Mid Prairie, they pulled me out and wouldn't and wouldn't put me back in the second half. And we were losing, so I was really mad. When I got home, I tried to pick up a glass of water, and my arm was just stuck. Luckily, Jeffrey's rehab went perfectly. He wasn't even tempted by a gym, since Blaze Fitness of West Liberty, the gym he trains at, was closed for a few months due to the pandemic. Jeffrey is a meathead when it comes to the weight room. He started competitive powerlifting at age 12, traveling the country and breaking records everywhere he went. He doesn't even remember all of them. In addition, he's amassed a collection of medals from the Junior Olympics in shot put and discus, and that was all before high school. Tom said, quote, I started him lifting young because I was 6'4 in eighth grade, but I weighed 135 pounds. I wanted to make sure that he did not. He was about 6'4, 200 pounds in eighth grade, so he didn't have to spend his high school training by catch-up. Tom said Jeffrey started breaking records at the state level in sixth grade, where he put an 8-pound shot 35 feet. It was his first throw, ever. Jeffrey played all 4 years of football on varsity for the Bears, spending time on the offensive and defensive line. He didn't like offensive tackle because much of the thrill comes from making defensive plays. In his past year's district championship game against Dyersville-Beckman, the Trailblazers were threatening a game-winning score on the Bears' 20-yard line. Jeffrey found the hole through the line and tackled the running back for a loss, sealing the win for the Bears. It was a year, he said, they hadn't won as many games, but it was a nice feeling to save the day. West Branch head coach Butch Peterson remembers many plays like that. He knew from the beginning Jeffrey would be a Division I player. Peterson said, quote, I think he's just a diamond in the rough. Another thing that Jeff has is he's hungry. He's going to live in that weight room, and he's going to eat the proper foods. A lot of kids will give you that talk, but he's going to show with action. When asked why he thinks Jeffrey got the loyalty tattoo, Tom said, quote, I don't know. Must be an opinion he has of himself. This is from on the back page of today's Gazette. The Dear Abby column. Man talks of will, but won't put it in writing. Dear Abby, I've been married to my husband for 7 years. We are in our 60s. He refuses to make a will. He tells me what he would put in his will and asks me if I am okay with his wishes. He has an adult child from his first marriage and would like to include her in the will. I'm fine with what he wants. This conversation has been going on for more than 5 years now, but he never acts on it. I'm very hurt and frustrated. The house is in his name, and my name isn't even on his checking accounts. I resent him for this. I also think he is being selfish and unloving to me and his adult child to leave us in a situation where we would have to go through the probate process. Please help me to get through him. Please help me to get through to him. And this letter is signed Resentful in Maine. Dear Resentful, your husband may be afraid to face the idea of his own mortality. He wouldn't be the first. The two of you need to make an appointment with an attorney who specializes in wills and estates. If he doesn't put his wishes in writing, the assets he has worked so hard for may be seriously diminished when the state decides for him and takes a sizable chunk out of the estate. While you are talking with the lawyer, there should also be a discussion of end-of-life planning. Does he want hospice, palliative care? Do you know what his wishes are in the event he is unable to speak for himself. Those wishes should be in writing, and so should yours. This should also be raised with your doctors. And that is the Dear Abby column for today. Here is a story from the living page of the Gazette. Time to remember. Holocaust survivor shares firsthand account of what can happen when people blindly follow a leader. This story is by Aaron Owen, a correspondent. Anne Frank had limited time to document her life as a Jewish girl hiding from German soldiers in Nazi-occupied Holland. Her story is well known to people who read The Diary of a Young Girl. The story of another girl imprisoned at Bergen-Belsen in Germany may be less well known to some. She, too, has a memoir about her life during World War II, Four Perfect Pebbles, a Holocaust story. Frank's diary represents an ending, while Marion Blumenthal Lausanne's book symbolizes a beginning. Lausanne has been sharing her story since 1979 and continues to reach audiences even during the pandemic. Eastern Iowans will have a chance to hear Lausanne's story at one of three Zoom presentations, 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. on Wednesday and Thursday, and 9 to 10 a.m. Thursday. Registration is required and is available at holocausteducate.org. The Thaler Holocaust Remembrance has arranged the presentations to educate the public on Holocaust Remembrance Day. Jim Bernstein of Cedar Rapids, chair of the Thaler Holocaust Education and Planning Committee, said with Holocaust survivors in their 80s and 90s, it's important to talk to young people so they can bear witness. Lausanne said, quote, the lessons are so important. Lausanne has seen firsthand what can happen when people blindly follow a leader and persecute others. Quote, if I reach one person, I have done my job. Lausanne was 4 years old on November 9th, 1938, when Kristallnacht, or Night of Broken Glass, shattered life as Jews knew it in Germany. Her family's possessions were taken, and her father was sent to Buchenwald, a concentration camp. Though he was released 3 weeks later, it would not be the last the family would see of the camps. The Blumenthal family, mother Ruth, father Walter, brother Albert, and Marion, left for Holland in January 1939, intending to sail to the United States. By December 1939, the family was still waiting and was sent to Westerbork, a refugee camp. There, for 4 years, Lausanne says, life was fine under Dutch control. In May 1940, 1 month before the family's departure date, the Nazis invaded Holland and destroyed their belongings. The 12-foot-tall barbed wire... Let me begin that sentence again. The 12-foot-tall barbed wire arrived when the SS took over Westerbork in July 1942. So did the lists of people to be deported. The people whose names appeared on lists posted Monday night were marched to the train station and taken away Tuesday morning. Of the 120,000 people who were left, Lausanne says, 102,000 died. Too young to know what was happening around her, Lausanne saw the conditions as a way of life. That would change in January 1944, when her family was shipped out of Westerbork. Initially glad for a change of environment, Lausanne said her new reality became clear upon seeing the cattle cars for transportation. Lausanne was 9 years old when the Blumenthal family arrived at Bergen-Belsen in Germany. With death all around and nothing to occupy her time, Lausanne used her imagination as a survival skill. She would collect shards of glass to reflect the sun's rays and create pets for herself. Lausanne set out daily in search of four pebbles of the same size and shape. If she could find them, Lausanne said, that meant her family would stay intact and survive the camp. She always found four pebbles, but Lausanne admits she cheated all the time. She said, quote, it was my game, and guess who made the rules? Her family did survive and was among the 2,500 people on the last three trains to leave Bergen-Belsen. They left April 9, 1945, 6 days before British troops liberated Bergen-Belsen. After 14 days on the train, German soldiers boarded, seeking civilian clothing to elude Allied forces. It was then they knew the war was coming to an end. Russian troops liberated the train and took the passengers to a nearby deserted village. Lausanne, then 10 and a half years old, emerged from the train weighing 35 pounds. In spring 1945, the family was ill with typhus, a highly contagious disease caused by filth and spread by lice. 6 weeks after liberation, her father died. After everything she endured, Lausanne believes people can overcome anything. It's all a matter of perspective. Lausanne benefited from her mother's positive attitude toward life. Lausanne said, quote, mental attitude toward life has a lot to do with physical health. Her mother's life validates that. Ruth Blumenthal died 6 weeks short of her 105th birthday. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 3rd. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. You can access a recording of today's reading of our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But When those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
.145/92 .180/111
.182/100 And I had a heart attack and a cardiac arrest, and then a stroke.
Your blood pressure numbers could change your life.
A lot of people don't understand, including myself, I didn't, now I do, the impact of having a stroke.
My memory is shot.
When I woke up, I couldn't speak.
Lowering your high blood pressure could save you from a heart attack or stroke. If you've stopped your treatment plan, restart it, or talk to your doctor about creating one that works better for you, start taking the right steps at manageyourbp.org.
It's a new life, but I'm going to make it better. I'm coming back. Ask your doctor, check your blood pressure.
Brought to you by the American Heart Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.